Hey yo, what's up? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 153. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, the Krizu, John Lindemann.
Yeah!
James Jones.
Yeah!
And Greg Lee.
Yes.
Nice. All right. We are here for you, the listener, and we're bringing the pain. Starting with Gradius Rebirth, Greg. I don't know, man. I heard this was not that great. I mean, I heard it was kind of just a...
It wasn't great, Ears.
So, Gradius Rebirth, yeah, this came out in Europe just last week, several months after America, which I think was several months after Japan. So, it's
pretty
been
much.
Quite a little odyssey to get here.
It's
in the
several months after several months.
Yeah, but interestingly, it actually, for that delay, came out at just 600 points. Which is, I think, 400 points less than what it came out for elsewhere. So I don't know whether that was a reflection of how it sold elsewhere, or perhaps how the Gradius Virtual Console games have sold over here relatively. Perhaps they think, you know, it definitely isn't going to fly if it's more expensive than those.
I could have sworn that you had this on when it came out in Japan.
No, because I didn't have my Japanese Wii yet when it came out in Japan.
Maybe you were just talking about it.
Yeah, I'm sure, because I was following it. I'm interested. I'm a big fan of the series and whatnot. And, of course, I did have Contra Rebirth when it came out in Japan. And it's an interesting comparison to make, actually, because I think this one, first of all, doesn't feel as satisfying as Contra Rebirth in the sense that... Even though Contra Rebirth is hardly a big game by any stretch of the imagination, considering it's only five levels, but it's all the action levels, it does kind of stack up with the number of sort of side-scrolling levels that there would be in a Contra 3, you know, very favourably. Whereas this, at five levels, does not stack up well with some of the Gradius games that are on Virtual Console at all, in the sense that you've got Gradius 2, which I think is something like 10 or 11 levels long, and then 3 is pretty much the same. In that sense, it looks a little weak, and I think some of the reason for that is that this is more a high-score skewed game. You've got online leaderboards, you can like save your replays, for reference value, possibly. I can't imagine anything that amusing.
You can see where you failed.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, it's like Star Soldier R.
It is a bit like Star Soldier R, but of course, the thing with Star Soldier R is that it's time limited. It's a 2-minute mode and a 5-minute mode or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is the score element of this game is simply one credit. And what happens is you'll start, you know, in the first level, and then if you beat all five levels that there are, or the main levels, I think there may be some sort of little secret pathways, sort of like Gradius Past, you know, like there was little shortcuts and things you could do in the old games, certainly in the first one. So there may be things like that I haven't discovered yet, because I haven't had it for very long. But with this, what will happen is you beat the five and you go around again if you were good enough to do that in one credit, and you'll keep going for as long as that credit lasts. And the loops do get harder, as you might imagine. There's more bullets and all that sort of thing. So there are some good things. There's some good things. It's a pretty straight-up Gradius game in most respects. So the level themes are very familiar. You have the sort of first volcano-style stage. You'll see the Moai heads, of course. You've got to have those.
Yes.
And it looks like a Super Nintendo game, pretty much. It
does look very much like that. There's a little more... The animation's a little more fluid. It does run generally much better than Gradius 3, which is no great achievement. But it does have some slowdown, which, again, relative to Contra Rebirth, is quite a disappointment, because that gets incredibly busy and there's never any. And, I mean, there really shouldn't be. So I'm not sure whether that was quote-unquote intentional or anything like that, but there is some, and that's kind of a shame, really, that it doesn't sort of up the ante a bit with that. But some of the good things I do like is that there's one level in particular, you get to this desert level, and there's all these like dinosaur skeletons everywhere for some reason. But what happens with that is that if you've got loads of weaponry, and you've got all the options and missiles and things, the missiles will actually blow up the skeletons and thrust all the bones into the air, which makes it a lot harder. So it kind of turns your firepower against you, which is quite unusual for a Gradius game, because normally it is simply, well, you know, the more firepower you've got, the easier it is. And of course, if you die and lose it, you're in trouble.
And also, you should pretty much never stop shooting in a Gradius game.
Yeah, there. That's another good point, because of course that's how you can try and sort of, you know, mitigate against it a little bit, is to constrain your firing. So I thought that was kind of, you know, cool kind of idea. And there's some other nice touches. It's probably got the best giant Moai head boss that I can recall from a Grady's game.
But, well, that's good. Yeah.
It's in the pantheon of Moai boss battles.
That's quite a statement.
It is, although I haven't played them all, that's for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's so, I think 600 points is probably more commensurate with its value. So it's definitely a more attractive pickup for the PAL Virtual Console. But I mean, it isn't, you know, definitely not anywhere near in the order of something like Gradius 5. It's not anywhere near as sort of innovative or interesting, or, you know, it's much more straight up, and it's still pretty well done, but not that well done. That's how I would characterize it.
And you're still playing Tiger?
Tiger 10, playing more. I'd only had it like for a day, so I played it for about an hour and a half or whatever last time. So I played it quite a bit more, and just the main thing I think about it that really works nicely is that it's sort of there's this line between, you know, being like a total simulation, you know, with Wii Motion Plus, you know, being sort of like virtual golf, essentially, and then it being a game. And it kind of, for me, with the Motion Plus controls, it straddles that line very nicely for my preferences, because definitely the nuance is there, that you feel more involved than you have in a golf game before. It feels more intricate. But at the same time, it is still a game. There's still certain sort of artificial constructions that make it easier to play. You know, I will never be a competent golfer, but I do hope to be something of a competent Tiger player, you know, and you can be that. And, you know, that's what makes it fun, is there's this kind of element of illusion of you being sort of competent at golf when you're not. Because the main way, one of the ways that it achieves that is that with the swing, your power is determined by two things. First, of the actual force with which you swing through with the remote. But the other thing is you kind of almost set your power first with how far you draw the remote back. So there's a sort of an element of almost picking your power, like it's sort of as you might have done when if you set a mark on a meter in old fashioned golf games. But that is then modified by how well you can actually sort of swing through with what you want to do. So that way it's not as totally dependent on exactly how you swing, which kind of, so there's a bit more of a predictability there, but you still have that kind of feel of getting it right. You're still very tactile. So that I think, I mean, I don't know, maybe other people will feel differently. Maybe they'd like it more if it was, you know, more like a virtual golf, as it were, or other people may prefer maybe to just if it were more like old school golf games. But for me, I think it's a really good balance, so I could see myself playing this for quite a while.
Now, two things I want to hear your thoughts on. First, online, and second, frisbee golf or disc golf.
Online, I have not tried yet. I just haven't got around to it. I've been playing local stuff, so it just hasn't really seemed. Apparently, yeah, I mean, the features seem pretty robust. So I should definitely be trying that out sometime, especially when you could sort of sync up with a live tournament that's going on.
Oh, yeah. And 'tis the season.
Yes, it is. So we'll have the Open not too long and so forth. So, yeah, that'll be interesting to try out. Frisbee golf, I've tried out a little bit. The hand tracking, you know, because you have just the disc in midair, and you can kind of, you know, just tilt the remote and see and tilt the disc accordingly. I mean, that's very impressive. You know, the one-to-one element there is really nice. I was absolutely awful at it, though. I just could not. I could not get it.
Well, how does it feel compared to Resort, Wii Sports Resort?
Whatever reason, Wii Sports Resort I got on better with sort of immediately. But then what I was playing from Wii Sports Resort was like the most basic stuff, like just where it's, you know, a few circles in the ground and you're just aiming to sort of put it in that general area, whereas this was, you are playing on, you've got actual sort of holes from courses, so I think it's a bit more challenging in that respect to start off. But you couldn't help but be impressed by the one-to-one tracking, because obviously that's not something that you really get that much of a sense of now, in the main game.
Did it feel really truly one-to-one? Because in our experiences at E3, some games didn't quite feel that way.
The thing is, I guess what you're not going to do when you're kind of trying to get the inclination of your frisbee right is do it really fast or anything. Mm-hmm. So it's not the most robust test.
Right.
But if you're just sort of, you're going through the angles, it did seem to replicate that very smoothly and very closely in terms of time. So yeah, I mean, I was impressed, but yeah, it's not the same as like tracking the sword motion or whatever.
No. Okay.
So what else?
Well, I did play a bit of Super Punch Out that came out in Japan. If you're wondering why I'm playing it now rather than when everyone else would have been playing it.
And is this your first time?
No, I rented it back in the mid-90s. And it's funny because I've forgotten how different it was in some ways because it doesn't have
very
rounds.
Very different, I would say.
It doesn't have rounds. I mean, that's kind of amazing to me.
I forgot
that there was such a big difference there. And the gameplay feels very stodgy compared to the new one. I mean, the new one puts it in pretty bad light, actually. It just doesn't feel anywhere near as fluid and immediate. You know, it's a bit staccato. I've still enjoyed it. It's very easy, actually, compared to the new one as well. I guess if you've just done Title Defense, you're kind of at the peak of your Punch-Out powers. If it can't really challenge you a great deal, but it is a bit easy.
Yeah, I actually played it, I guess, about a few months ago, and yeah, I was actually surprised. It was much easier than I remember the Punch-Out games being.
See, it kicked my ass. I don't think I got past the second guy.
Yeah, I didn't get past, what is it, Hurricane? Pissing Hurricane?
Okay, that's the third boxer of the first circuit, yeah. I mean, really, if you apply yourself, they're not very difficult. They're compared to
Title Defense, and I found this to be relatively easy.
I mean, to me, the difficulty only really starts when you get to the sort of special final circuit. The rest of it, maybe Super Macho Man. Is kind of, but before that, it's just not very. And of course, what that means is that it feels very insubstantial, because I mean, it has 16 fighters, which is relatively quite a lot for a Punch-Out game. But you just, especially because you don't even have the round structures. I mean, these are over quickly. I mean, these fights are just done most of the time. And the way the Super Punch works differently, because they're not sort of consumable in the same way. So you build up the meter, and as long as you don't get hit, which sort of brings the meter down, you can keep using it. Which means, once you learn to dodge, you could just keep pummeling them with that, and it's over really quickly.
I guess I'm just really bad at Punch-Out games, period. Because I thought it was even harder than the NES game. But then maybe with the NES game, I have sort of a
muscle memory. That's what it is, Johnny.
I don't think that's it at all, John. Since you're just pressing buttons.
It's still fun. But I mean, if I bought that, I think it was much more appropriate to rent it back in the day and then pay, 800 points for it now.
I think most people didn't do either. Back in the day, especially. All right, James, do you want to talk about The Conduit first?
Well, I think we can all discuss The Conduit, so let's go that route first.
Well, you had barely played it last week.
I had, and I have replayed the entire game with the exception of the last level twice now. For embarrassing reasons that I'd rather not discuss.
Does it not even ask you, are you sure you want to delete this profile?
It kind of does, but I was busy talking to you people trying to get an online game going.
Well, the thing is, you're not given the implications of what you're doing.
Yeah, it just like, yes,
I did. I did the same thing with mine.
I knew you did because you said, "Well, when you start a new game, you get a new friend code." I'm like, John must have done it too.
Yeah, I did. I was like, okay, first off, you can't rename the name on your save file, which is dumb.
No.
Which means
that is very dumb.
Which means, so my first thought was, well, I'll just delete my save file. Okay. And then the next time I log on to online, I'm like, I have a new friend code. What the hell just happened?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
So if you can't figure out what happened, I was setting up my first online match ever with Johnny, and I deleted my save file, including my nearly complete playthrough of the game. So,
well, at this point, you've been through about five different friend codes.
Yes, I have. So then I started deleting them. The next one I deleted, I hadn't played anything. I deleted it trying to figure out how I managed to do that the first time without realizing what happened. The second time I did it again, but I still hadn't played anything. And then the third, and then we actually played online. And then the third time I went back and gave myself an actual friend code, a friend name, versus what I had before, which was the default.
So if you've played through the single player twice, you must like it.
No, I'm just the completist.
No, I hate it.
I don't hate it. It's just, I'm a completist. I have to see the end of the game. It's just the way I am.
You'll definitely feel cheated, James.
As long as I don't completely despise a title, I'll play it through to the end.
Well, you and I were talking when we were playing online the other day. We were talking about the level designs in single player.
Yes.
And I think we both agree that they really kind of dropped the ball on making good usage of these landmarks in Washington.
Yeah, because, they really did that.
Like, it's a really cool idea to put a shooter level in the Library of Congress, but like, it doesn't look anything like the Library of Congress, and even if it did, that would obviously be a bad idea because it's a really boring, crappy looking level.
Yeah, same thing with the Pentagon as well.
Yeah, the Pentagon is like,
and the White House too.
The whole game.
My favorite part of the Pentagon is there's just like this random thing. It's like the back alley, and you just run down all these scaffolding outside, and that's what they made the multiplayer level out of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, why did they pick this to be the multiplayer level? Because, and this is an issue because when I played with John and Johnny yesterday, the two of them were engaged on that level in what might be the worst firefight in the history of online games, in which neither of them managed to hit each other at close range.
Yeah.
Well, I'm standing way the hell back just trying to hit them like an asshole, and I'm missing two. And this whole they go on for about 20 seconds of just complete stupidity. And it was the worst.
I did hit Johnny with several insults though.
No.
some real mean ones.
He had a good accuracy rate on that. But I mean, to go back to the level design real quick, I don't think all the levels are bad. I think the Jefferson Memorial level is very cool.
Uh-huh.
And I think the subway level is pretty cool. And I think the stuff after you step through the big giant conduit that's in the prologue, I think that stuff is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel like it's really inconsistent. The level design, it's either like, oh, this is actually pretty interesting and they've set up some good arenas for firefights with the computer, or it feels like you're walking through boring corridors mm-hmm. for like an hour. Because some of the levels get really long.
It's almost back to like Bond 64 level design of just
exactly.
hallways and rooms.
Yeah, I mean, without the sort of mission objective based design,
it's really just clear the enemies get to the next room.
Yep.
Right, but on a mm-hmm. geometric level, yeah, I feel like it is a lot like GoldenEye.
I think that they picked decent levels for the multiplayer, but none of them are particularly big. I think if you had the maximum number of people online, it'd feel kind of cramped.
I don't know about cramped. I mean, generally, you want to be close to the other players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you want there to be enough space that you can be safely generated into the level.
Yeah, some of the respawning is kind of sketchy because I've had that where, like, I will literally pop up right in front of somebody and they will kill me. I mean, I'll pop up in front of them. They'll be looking right at me and they'll shotgun me, one-shot me. And I never even had a chance.
And then you get to go back into your 20 seconds of silence.
Yeah.
That's another weird thing is that you can't talk in the WeSpeak when you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange choice.
Yeah, we saw that last night where just the microphone is constantly being turned off and turned on and turned off and turned on.
Yeah, and I mean, it makes sense. Like, you see this in Team Fortress and stuff like that when you're actually in a team game, because once you die, you go into spectator mode and you can see what the other players are doing. So it makes sense to cut off your communication with your own team so you can't help them after you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
But in a free-for-all game, what is the point of turning off the voice chat for 10 seconds at a time when you die?
But, I mean, you can resolve that on a team game by just saying you only get to spectate your team.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
It's weird because not only do they do it there, they do it after the match. And what is it? It's 20 seconds there, too? Where everybody just
sits... Yeah, it's 15, 20 seconds.
Everybody just sits in silence.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, well, we sure would like to be...
Yeah, that is when you would want to do the smack talk.
And you'd be like, oh...
I think this should be like a sort of WeSpeak version of the F0X roulette of death. And then, you know, if John managed to get a particularly good insult in, it's three skulls and then everyone dies.
Yes. Mini game, now.
Well, the biggest bug, I mean, the WeSpeak is a mess, and maybe some of that's not, High Voltage's fault.
You lose.
Yeah, this is the most fucked up thing. I mean, and it happened over and over and over again that when James and John and I would start up a game, you know, we'd all vote for our weapon sets and our levels and everything, and then it would count down and load up the level, and the very instant that the level loads, the match ends. And no one's even moved or fired a shot yet.
Yeah.
And it's over, and it kicked, and you have to wait another 20 seconds with no voice chat to get back to the lobby just to do it all over again. And the next time, it'll usually work.
Well, I mean, I was even experiencing worse stuff than that. I mean, and it was doing this pretty much every day I would try it is I would jump into regional or worldwide, and it would sit there, and you know how it normally counts down, maybe like, you know, from 20, it would loop, and it would go to five minutes.
Yes.
And then that would count down, and then so I'd have to sit there and watch it count down while it's trying to add other players. Then I would get dropped into the match, and my guy would be frozen. And so I could see other people running
that
around.
That happened to me once, too.
It happened to me all the time.
8.5.
And so I would have to turn off my Wii to get out of it.
8.5.
I just waited for the match to end.
it's kind of funny because I mean, we had fun playing it last night.
Oh, yeah.
It is definitely fun, but it is fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, it is just... It's, seriously.
Yeah, it's goofy.
It's fun because we are fun people.
No,
seriously. And on a base level, the shooting is fun.
Yep.
But the game is just...
But if you are not fun, do not buy this game.
It's a mess. All right, James, so what about Hawks?
Yes.
Hawks.
I'm not even sure Hawks. Hawks, I guess. H-A-W-X. So this
Kentucky
game,
Fried Hawks.
This game got a price drop this week to $20, which is, you know, a decent price for any 360 game nowadays, unfortunately. And I went and I picked it up thinking, oh, well, you know, from the demo I played, it tries way, way hard to be an Ace Combat ripoff. And it does. I mean, they mess with the control a little bit, but basically...
It's more fun than Ace Combat.
No, it's less fun.
I'm amazed at that response.
It is because it's just got these little things that are really kind of grating. Like, the game is super serious. I know it's a Tom Clancy game, but come on, you're sending two fighter planes to wipe out an entire army. How serious can you really be?
I'm going to say that Tom Clancy has never even laid eyes on this game. He probably doesn't know it exists.
No, I doubt he does.
It's just set in his universe or whatever you want to call
it. Yeah, well, you know, Ubisoft bought the right to his name, so they don't even have to ask his permission to put his name on something.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I think the game almost lacks a personality. So it's like, we have to be Ace Combat. And it goes so far as, in Ace Combat, the first screen you see is the license holders of all the aircraft they use. So it's a bunch of weapons system companies. First screen you see in this game is the exact same screen with even that weird, this weird, like, ripply background image that's exactly the same they used in Ace Combat, which is bizarre. But then when you actually go into the game, it's just like the same five or six lines of dialogue repeated by your pilots over and over again about how, oh, missile's coming. It's kind of annoying.
Well, it's meant to be played in online co-op.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not hooked up for that right now.
Oh.
I feel like even if a game is meant to be played in online co-op, they should put enough work into the single player that you're not, you know, annoyed by little things like that.
Well, I'm surprised that more games like this haven't been done for Wii. Although we did just find out that Skycrawler is coming to America.
I'm curious if maybe this means the source material of that particular game is going to be brought over too.
The anime. Yeah. So that's the thing. It's because of the Innocent Aces subtitle kind of, you know, it's the link to letting you know that it's got something to do with Ace Combat in terms of development. But yeah Skycrawler's in an anime.
James's nickname is now the Innocent Ace, by the way. Nice. I would like to bring that up.
No comment.
So yeah, with Wii, of course, like you use the nunchuck, I think, in your right hand or something. It's a little unorthodox.
I can understand why they did it, but I'm not sure it was a good idea.
Well, I know that one import review that I did read totally slammed the motion controls.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
Said you're better off using. Are the they GameCube optional? Controls. But yeah, GameCube controls can be used. So yes, they are.
I wonder if they'll put in classic also.
I may well do. It wouldn't surprise me. So I guess there's that. But you know, often with motion controls, they seem to be a matter of taste. There is a significant sort of disparity in opinion about these sorts of things. Like you saw it with Okami, for instance.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a matter of taste, assuming they do it right.
Yeah. If they're unambiguously bad, well, then that is a problem that everyone will detect. Whereas if it seems even if they are somewhat pretty good, then some people who like that kind of more immediate connection, that kind of more sort of tangible connection with the game, kind of like it. And then other people just know I like to play my games this way. But they have accommodated both, so that's the good news.
It's funny because I feel like you get the complaint more when they do accommodate both, that the motion controls are bad. And my only theory is that it's because they don't people will play it for a little bit, go, I don't like this, and then move on to the
next. Sort of say, oh no, when the option's there, they don't kind of take the time to acclimatize.
Yeah. Well, and back on Hawks, it's really fucking easy. Like, I'm like,
I've heard that.
Probably like level 6 or 7, and I haven't died yet at all.
Well, but you're a well-known expert in this genre.
I'm playing
you're
it
the instant ace.
I'm playing it between the second highest difficulty setting here. I mean, I should at least be getting some resistance.
You're just that good.
No, I'm not.
A noted aficionado.
I would say it fills the gap between the Ace Combat and the next one, but it's not doesn't have the same level of polish as its source material, and there's not as much depth to the content.
It's your scientific speciality.
What the hell?
That was a never-ending story reference. Yeah. Ta-da!
Take that, obscurity.
I thought you were going to be all over this, but I guess I didn't take into account your discernment.
It's good, but it's just not there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain lack of experience in its development that showed.
All right. Well, Mr. Lindemann.
Yes, sir?
It's your turn.
Yeah, it was a big day in the Lindemann household. Sega sent me a copy of Let's Tap.
Oh, yeah!
Woo! So, yes.
Are you going to review this, man?
That's the thing. I think either I will or Neil will. I got to sort that out.
You have to review this, John.
You're on the Sega review kick now.
Well, that's the thing. We kind of set it up where I bought the copy of Conduit and then reviewed it, and he got the review copy of it. So I think we may switch it around for Let's Tap, because I think he's already bought Let's Tap.
No, you have to review this game.
I got the review copy.
Let's face it. I mean, what really happened is Sega saw your Conduit score, and they're like, we have to send this guy more.
They're like, oh!
Yeah. We got to keep this coming.
So that's good, but we need something a little bit extra. I forwarded them the outtakes of you singing along to the Let's Tap theme song, and that pushed it
Why were there any outtakes there?
Yeah, I mean, it was all intakes to me.
John, is it too late for unboxing videos?
Yes, it is.
Rebox.
Well, see, that's
Rebox.
Can we at least just get a video of you playing it and singing along?
Yes, I can do that.
Okay. I request.
Okay,
please.
Absolutely. I'll put on a Tap de Papaya or whatever it is.
Yes.
And we'll see. I'll see what I can do. I'll talk to my people.
John, what do you think of Let's Tap?
I think it's pretty good. I don't think it's. It reminds me of my first impression is, and bear in mind that I played it for about an hour, but that's actually enough. There's 16 different tracks. Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's 16 different tracks, and I unlocked 12 of them, and I don't know how you unlock the other four.
Last ability, 10.
Well, it's probably like something like you have to get an A in all of the other tracks or something like that. I don't even know. But
so what are these tracks exactly?
They're all J-pop.
Of course they are. It's
But when you play through them, are you doing different like activities?
No. What the gameplay is like, then this is only one mode. There's actually 5 modes. The most rhythm game like mode, or at least like straight like kind of Guitar Hero style mode is. It reminds me of the game Beats. I mean, I'm not even gonna pretend that anybody's ever played that game on the PSP. But what that is you have little kind of colored dots moving from left to right. And then you
it's
tap
a bit,
along
bit like
to the
Donkey
beat.
Konga, right?
Yeah.
As well, isn't it?
Yeah. Like you tap along to the beat kind of thing. And so what you do is you get a cardboard box, put your controller face down on it, and then you tap along. It can register hard and soft taps, so you can kind of gauge how hard you tap. And that comes in some of the other games. Like there's a running game where, you know, you sit there, it's kind of track and field style, where you sit there and tap with both fingers. But yeah, it reminds me of like it has backgrounds at least in the rhythm game part. They remind me a lot of Rez on the PS2. If you've played that, where they're all really like colorful kind of polygons, very computerish kind of thing, grid like.
Rez is known as a very beautiful game.
Yeah,
I mean
it's
that's high praise.
It looks pretty good, and there's a lot of varied backgrounds too. It looks really cool. There's a visualizer game which is pretty cool. You know, it's not
first
score.
There's a number of those, isn't there? Is it like that are just sort of like little. Like toys, almost, you know, that you just kind of play with the tapping and it makes some sort of visual interpretation of that on the screen.
Yeah, like the one I played was fireworks. So if you tapped in different ways, you would do different. Like it's kind of like a you're letting off fireworks over a city, you know, of like these skyscrapers, and the way you tap determines what kind of fireworks explode over the city. So that's pretty cool. The other thing is kind of a pseudo platformer. What it's exactly like are the water parts of the original Super Mario Brothers. They're exactly like that. So it's probably a lot like Jungle Beat, where you sit there and every time you tap, you have this little kind of anime style, you know, spaceman kind of thing, and you try to avoid obstacles like exploding mines and stuff like that that are in midair. And you tap and he goes up, and then he falls down, and you tap some more and he keeps going up, and you do that. But yeah, it's pretty good. I wouldn't say there's probably the most depth to it from what I've seen so far, but I mean it's less than $30, and it's kind of meant as just like sort of like a fun experience. Yeah,
it's pretty cheap. I mean, I almost picked it up yesterday. Instead, I went with the Hawks. But, John, I have to ask, did you get the tap pad? Did Sega send you a tap pad?
Nope. I didn't get the limited, the Best Buy limited edition one.
Stiffed on the chamois.
Yep.
With you guys talking about Donkey Konga, it just makes me bewildered that Nintendo, or Namco, I guess, haven't done a Donkey Konga game for Wii. It just seems such a natural fit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to think, like, especially with the balance board now, you could have basically motion controls in your hands, or plug in the DK bongos, heaven forbid, and then you could have some stuff going on with the balance board, too. Or you could even use your hands on the balance board, you know, and kind of be... I mean, it won't have the same... sort of feedback
It'll
that the bongos
too.
Did.
If you do it,
well,
long
you
enough.
Don't have to hit it that hard.
Was it? I think was it that Taiko drum game?
Yes, Taiko drum
in Japan.
Master.
That's one of the best-selling games of the year so far in Japan. Although it's been a down year for the Japanese game market, but yeah, I mean the market is clearly there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't get much simpler than that. So I mean, I think they could do something more interesting than Taiko with Donkey Konga.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I guess it's my turn now. I've been doing a lot of stuff. I got Bit Trip Core, which is the new WiiWare game, the sort of the follow-up to Bit Trip Beat. And Core is a little hard to explain. So it's similar to Bit Trip Beat in that you have these sort of, you know, pixel-y squares flying around, and you basically have to, you know, do something with them. It all looks like an old Atari 2600 game. And it's kind of a rhythm game. It's just, you know, music, chip tunes kind of playing in the background. And you always have to do actions on the with the beat of the music. And with Core, instead of playing Pong and sort of bouncing these things off, this is a little bit more like a shoot 'em up, I guess, in that these dots are flying in from all different sides of the screen, and you control this plus sign looking thing right in the center. And as the dots basically pass from one quadrant of the TV screen into another, you have to shoot it right as it crosses that threshold. And it looks really hard when you watch somebody do it. In practice, as you play it, it's not quite as demanding because you have the music. So if you listen to the music and you follow the beat, it doesn't take too long to kind of start developing the visual recognition of, well, if this one's going this way, I know it's going to cross the plane here, and so that's the direction I need to shoot to hit that dot. You know, and it throws these patterns at you that can be very confusing the first time you see it, but after you go through it a couple times, you get, okay, I need to switch directions back and forth really fast. As long as I do it on the beat, I'll be okay. So it's somewhat easier to play than it looks, but it's still a very challenging game. And so was Bit Trip Beat. And I really, you know, I don't think they're going to change that as they continue on through the planned series of six games in this little franchise they've developed. But I don't think they should make it easier. I mean, I think that's a good thing. But I know they've already gotten a lot of feedback about, you know, there's only three levels, but they're all like 15 minutes long. And the game would feel a lot more playable if you would just break them up into smaller pieces, like have the same amount of content. I have no issue with the amount of content you get for $6. I think it's a good value. But a lot of people will never even get to see the later levels the third level of three, just because the game is so hard and it's just the way it's broken up. So I really feel like, you know, I've been playing for like 5-6 minutes, I'm doing really well, and then all of a sudden it throws a sequence at me that just is totally overwhelming and I can't get past it. Well, the 5 or 6 minutes that I've really pretty much mastered before that doesn't count for shit. because I have to play through that all over again the next time, and I'll probably lose at the exact same place. So it just makes more sense to break it up, to give you a better feeling of accomplishment, and to make it easier to practice on the parts that really give you problems.
Yeah, that's,
you know?
That's pretty unforgiving.
Yeah.
It is very unforgiving, and again, like, the actual gameplay mechanic is not that difficult. It's not that hard to grasp, but I think the way that they have built the game and the way that they pace it makes it harder than it should be, you know? And supposedly they're planning on making some changes to that in the series, but BitTrip Core was too far along in development at the time when BitTrip Beat came out and people started saying these things. So the idea is that maybe in the third game and on, they're going to start responding to those to that feedback a little bit better. I don't know. We'll see. I still think Core is good, and especially if you like the first one, if you like Beat, you'll probably like this too. But you just have to keep in mind that it's very much the same philosophy of very difficult, very old school. You have to have very good rhythm. It's very cool also. So, I mean, it has the same strengths and the same weaknesses. Have any of you guys considered picking this up? I mean, did you have any interest in it?
I'd probably go with the first one before that. It seems like people like it a little better.
I think I like Beat better, too.
Yeah, that's the vibe I've picked up, so that would be my... It definitely appeals to me, and I think they fixed some problem with the... There was a problem with the American one, was there? Something to do with saving or something?
Yeah, and it came out in Europe later, and they fixed that bug.
That all sounds so even just one of the, because it was reviewed very favorably, Beat in America, but that was one of the issues, and that was corrected. So yeah, right. I mean, I would definitely consider going back to that at some time.
All right, well, the next thing I did, more WiiWare stuff here. I kind of, after I bought Core, I still had 300 points left in my account.
This is how they get you.
Oh, boy.
This is how they get you.
Nickel and dime,
I thought, what can I do with 300 points? I don't feel like loading in another 10 bucks right now, because then I'll feel compelled to spend it on something that I don't care that much about, you know?
You could just let it sit there. I mean, it won't...
There's no clock on WiiWare, I don't think.
Yet.
There's a screensaver.
Screensaver?
That aquarium
the
thing
fish,
that Hudson did.
Yes.
But anyway, I mean, I had kind of wanted to check out one of the optional episodes for Final Fantasy IV After Years anyway. And so I thought, well, this might be a good time to do it, because there was one... They're releasing them on a kind of a funny schedule. So when the game launched, the first half of the main story is what you get for your 800 points.
Yeah.
So they're basically two episodes... making up the main story, and the second half of it, the second episode in the main story, comes out in September. So for right now, you only get the first half of the story, and it kind of leaves on a major cliffhanger. And then they also launched it with one of the side stories available, which is Rydia's Tale. And she's definitely one of the most interesting characters in the, you know, in the FF4 story. She's the summoner, and she has black magic and green hair, and she hangs out in the underworld a lot. So that's 300 points, and I thought, well, I like Rydia, I like the underworld, I kind of want to see how much do you really get for your $3, what is the side story like. And so I just went ahead and downloaded it, and as it turns out, the side story is, I'd say, more than half as long as the main 800 point piece that I already went through. I think it's very substantial. It's probably, I mean, I'm not even finished with it yet, but from what I can tell, it's roughly 3, 4, 5 hours, depending on how you play. For $3 is pretty good, you know, and you get a little bit of new music, a few new items. You get to play as some characters that you've seen before, but you've never gotten to play as before, without giving too much away. But it's really interesting, and if you're a nut for Final Fantasy IV like I am, it's totally worth it, you know? So now I'm thinking, oh, geez, they're going to rope me into, like, buying the other 6 optional stories, and then in September I get to pay 800 more points for the conclusion to the main thing, which I probably won't even remember what happened by then. So,
need a previously segment.
It is going to get expensive if I end up getting all of them, and I'll probably just cherry pick, because, like, a character like Yang, I never did like him very much, so I probably wouldn't bother with his story.
I have to agree with that sentiment.
But, like, Palom, I think, is great, because he's funny, and he has interesting abilities, and he's going to go to interesting places, so he's like a real ladies' man in this one, because he's grown up, you know, it's several years later. So I think that one's going to be entertaining. I'll probably check that out. So what happened is this month in July, they released three more of the character side stories for 300 points each. And then in August, they're going to release the final three. And then in September, we get the conclusion for 800. So the whole thing, if you buy everything, is like $37. But when you add up all the playtime, it's probably a 30-hour game. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe not such a bad deal. It is an RPG on WiiWare, and maybe this is the only way they could do it, or maybe this is the only way it's financially viable, or maybe Square Enix is just screwing us over because they know we're fans.
Well, Square Enix,
when they can't.
All of the above.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, how much do you think the game will be worth when it's all said and done? $30? Like, is it equivalent to like a DS game?
I mean, it's a sequel to Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah.
So it will be about as long as the original game. I mean, maybe it won't be as epic because they are reusing a lot of assets. They're kind of, you're visiting the same places. Maybe they've changed a little bit. So it's not like they made a whole new game from scratch that's totally original and surprising and all that. It's fan service, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a fanfic that you get to play. But it's pretty good. So it's probably going to be a little overpriced when all said and done. But at the same time, I don't have to spend $37 on it.
Yeah.
If I want the main story, it's $16 for roughly 10 hours of gameplay, 8 to 10 hours of RPG. That's fine with me. Mm-hmm. That's fine. And then I can choose what other stuff I want to do, and I don't have to do all of it. And I probably won't. So overall, I don't feel as ripped off as I thought I would. I don't feel...
A rousing endorsement.
Yeah, but I mean, I really don't feel any negativity towards the game or the structure that they're releasing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I was very, very against it. I was like, I may end up paying for this stuff, but I'm not going to be happy about it. And at this point, I'm not necessarily happy about it, but I'm cool with it. So it's won me over, I guess. But I'll reiterate, this is for, like, real serious fans of Final Fantasy IV only. Like, if you haven't even played the original game, don't touch this. It won't even make sense. Like, the story just assumes that you know the plot of the original game thoroughly. But, hey, if you played the DS game last year, as you should have, I think you'll probably like this.
Yeah, recent familiarity would probably be very good.
All right. So, enough of that. I did rent Resident Evil 5 this week. And, God, this game's been so controversial, not only for the... accusations of racism, but also because it seems just very divisive in terms of gameplay. Like, some people just really hate it. Hate it. Mm. And these are people who liked RE4. And that I don't get, because it is RE4. Have any of you guys played it yet?
I've played it, but I haven't played it for an extended amount of time.
Okay. Well, I've only played it for a couple hours. I'm in, like, chapter 2-2 or something, so I'm not very far into it. But even with all my expectations and having read reviews and heard people talk about it on podcasts and stuff, like, yeah, I am still a little shocked at how much it is exactly like Resident Evil 4. And mechanically, that's mostly a good thing. Like, it's still fun to shoot dudes, and the graphics are absolutely amazing. Although the graphics don't seem like a massive upgrade, but that's just because RE4 already looks so damn good. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel nearly as fresh, and that's what made me love RE4 so much. I mean, being a pretty much a public hater of the Resident Evil series before I played 4, the magic of that game was that it just turned my expectations around so drastically, and it made me almost instantly fall in love with something that I really didn't think I was going to like very much. And that's definitely not going to happen for anybody with RE5, because it's just... total rehash.
Well, you know, my thought here is that since RE4, there have been a lot of games that came out that basically copied RE4 verbatim.
Gears of War is pretty, I mean, not verbatim, but it is heavily based on that, and then they added a ton of new stuff also.
Right, and game design has naturally progressed beyond that. I think people almost felt like, well, this feels kind of dated.
It does feel dated.
Yeah, I think each time you played RE4, it felt, you know, less engrossing, and I feel like playing RE5 is like playing an RE4 add-on.
Yeah, it feels kind of like an expansion pack or whatever. I mean, it's just a very super conservative sequel, and the one thing that they changed, of course, was the co-op, adding the second character, and... Again, I'm early in the game, but so far, it's not that the other character is pissing me off. I mean, I've played it a little bit with the computer, and I've played it with a couple strangers over Xbox Live who we weren't communicating. They didn't have their headsets in. So, kind of like a more intelligent computer, I guess. But it's not that it's broken or that I don't like it. It just doesn't feel like it really adds anything to the experience. I mean, playing through RE4, which I've done fairly recently because of the Wii edition, which I love, I never stopped and thought, damn, I wish there was another person here who could shoot dudes with me. Like, it just doesn't really
just
work
think it's a bit
with
of
the
a,
gameplay.
A bit of a sort of perfunctory thing where it was like, well, we've got to add something. And of course,
it just
you know,
seems
go into the
superfluous, you know.
Yeah, to go into the HD consoles with their online capabilities, you know, that was kind of the natural thing to add, and that's pretty much so. In its own way, still very much by the numbers.
I guess I would just compare it to like maybe a first-person shooter that has online multiplayer, just because people expect that it should, not because it really makes sense with the game.
Yeah,
like, it just seems kind of tacked on. And
Metroid Prime 2 multi.
Yeah,
which that is really fun for like 2 hours.
I wouldn't even. I'd say an hour.
You might be surprised with the new Wii controls. I bet you're gonna find that it's worth your time to like
do some split screen
because Echo's multiplayer is really really fun. There just aren't enough.
Just no
there aren't enough weapons. There aren't enough levels. There's
yeah,
not enough
it's
content.
The feature set is very limited, isn't it?
But, yeah, RE5, like, it's totally fine, but it's also totally boring. It's, like, not really drawing me in very much so far. Like, sometimes during the cutscenes, I go back to my computer and read email, because I just don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like your response to it was kind of like my response to it. I mean, I haven't played it, but then again, I had no desire to play it at all, because I didn't feel like I'd be seeing anything new. So,
yeah.
I mean, because everything I saw, I was like, yeah, that looks just like RE4 with a two-player mode. There's nothing.
So far, I haven't really seen anything new.
Yeah.
But the last thing I've been doing a lot of this week, and I don't want to talk about this much, but I have been reading a book, actually rereading a book, called Ender's Game, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with this. It's been around for a long time. But I read it my first year of college, which was more than 8 years ago now. And I just, the first time I read it, this book was so addictive that I pretty much blew through it in like one night, maybe two nights. And so, like, I enjoyed it immensely, but I just went through it so fast, it didn't really stick in my brain very well. And I remembered liking it more than I actually remembered what happens in the book. So it's one that I had kind of been wanting lately to get back and read again, and I picked it up for a couple bucks at a local store, and just it is really blowing me away all over again. So I just wanted to throw this out there because I know a lot of people are familiar with it. And if you've never read this, you really should. Have you guys read this?
Yeah. No,
I haven't.
Only James.
Yeah, I had to read it in high school.
That's a little bizarre to me that people would have get this as an assignment just because it's so awesome.
I went to
did you like it, James?
Confused high school.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. It did. The whole time I was reading, I'm like, why am I reading this as a school assignment? So
yeah.
There was sort of a weirdness there, but...
I mean, yeah. What's it about?
It's about some dude who plays a game in an Ender. Jeez, man.
Well...
I mean, technically, yes, it is.
No, it's about this very young little boy. He's like 6 years old. He's a super genius, and he gets recruited into this combat school where the kids go into this zero-gravity room, and they basically play rugby or football. Or it's more like laser tag, I guess, but in zero-gravity. And his life for years revolves around like learning to play this game and figuring out how to master it.
Basically, he comes up with a really cheap way of winning the game consistently.
Nah, he wins it in about 100 different ways. James is not remembering it very well. But it's really amazing, and for some reason, I feel like it has this kind of deep kinship with video games. Like, there's something about the descriptions of this battle room and the game that they play in there that feels like I'm playing a game while I read about it. And yet, there's really not, I mean, there are computer games that they play in their free time, but they're not really a major part of the book. So I don't feel like the book is about video games, but I feel like it's about the same thing
that
video games are about.
Towards the end, the computer game they play becomes more important and more prominently featured.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that's not the main part of the book, you know. Anyway, I just kind of, it was interesting to me, and I've been sleepless most nights of the week because I've been reading this book, and I just kind of wanted to throw it out there. So if any of our readers kind of know what I'm talking about, if you have any kind of... I'm having a hard time expressing what I even mean when I say that about the connection with video games. But I mean, if you have thoughts on it, you know, send them in, and I'd be very interested to hear what you think.
Would you say that he's playing a murder simulator in the
yes,
game?
Yes, I would. Exactly.
sort of, yeah.
if only Jack Thompson was here.
Yeah. That's my new business, and I guess we're going to take a break now and come back with Retroactive Number 7, Ninja Spirit. Alright, welcome back for segment two of the show, and you know, Greg, he stays up real late to do this, and I don't think he's feeling too chipper tonight, but I know what will cheer him up, and it's Ninja Spirit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's like a shot of serotonin into my eyeball.
Well, I mean, this seems like the kind of game that would be right up your alley.
Mm-hmm.
But of all the retroactive games we've done, this is the one that I had the least familiarity with of any.
Yeah, me too.
Not that I mean, I've owned a lot of them, or at least or played some of them if I didn't own them, or knew a lot about them. I haven't played them a great deal with this one. Didn't really know a lot about it. My main familiarity with it comes just from like when it came out on Virtual Console, just reading reviews and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not one of those TG16 games that I was like that was that famous for any reason when with the import.
Well, it's not a shooter.
Yeah.
But
stuff like Splatterhouse was quite famous. Obviously, yeah, the shooters, Gunhead, Star Soldier, Devil's Crush was also sort of quite. Well,
and Bonk,
publicized.
Of course.
Yeah, Bonk, yeah.
It was
PC
actually a very highly regarded game when it came out, apparently.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, well,
the infamous
first 10 ever
10.
From EGM.
Yeah, that's what I was surprised to hear, that you know. But apparently that didn't really trans... I guess there wasn't the... You know, this was well before the sort of internationalization of the gaming media.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the interesting thing about that is that that's really a product of when this was released. I mean, this was pretty much going up against NES games. So compared to NES games...
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, was it 1990, I want to say?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
In America, yeah.
So, I mean, it was also going up against early Genesis games.
Yeah, and it fares very well against those, I would say.
Yeah. Those
Put this up against Genesis version of Altered Beast.
I didn't come in with a lot of baggage or anything, or expectations, or, you know, so it was quite, the main attachment I've got with it is developed by Irem.
Yeah.
Who are developers of R-Type.
Yep.
And that is a really, really excellent game, and the PC Engine version is actually a very good conversion there. So I was kind of interested to see it from that point of view, and Johnny talked about, just when he was introducing the game, some of the similarities with the shoot 'em up, and they're definitely there. Although I noted with some curiosity that there's somewhat more similarity with Gradius than there is with R-Type, which is bizarre. Mm-hmm. Well, because first of all, you've got the Shadow Selves things, or whatever they're called, that are like options, basically. You know, you have little
true.
Clones of yourself going around, you're swinging and using your weapons at the same time as you swing yours and so forth. And you can kind of move around to configure their position, like with options as well. So, I mean...
Yeah, and they work the same way as in Ninja Gaiden 2, but these were done first if you go by when Ninja Spirit was out in the arcades.
Mm, yes, yeah. So, I mean, that I thought was interesting, very true to, like, very Gradius. Like, also, slightly more sort of minute thing, but there are certain enemies that yield power-ups, and these enemies are coloured orange, just like the enemies in Gradius that give up the power.
It's true.
It's strange that...
It's kind of a conspiracy.
It's strange that Irem would crib from Gradius when they had their own legendary shooter for this. But yeah, so I mean, there is a certain shooter sensibility. In particular, the arcade version of the game and the arcade mode in this, the TurboGrafx game, is you get hit once, you die. by anything. That is that, you know, so that is very much like a shoot 'em up also. But they have what's called the PC Engine mode, which of course is the Japanese name for the TurboGrafx. So basically all they mean is sort of how they changed it for the home, whereby you had, was it 5 hits that you're allowed before you die?
I think this is the default, because I didn't even realize there was an option to...
Yeah, there is an option. Kills. You can put it in arcade mode, and that means one hit, you are dead.
You
no
go
question.
Down.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, not
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, so, I mean, that I thought was quite good. That is just like a shooter. I mean, and it's not even one hit and you're dead like Contra, because in Contra you do have multiple lives. So
yeah, it's brutal.
You lose a life, but you spawn back instantly until you lose all your lives, and then you go back to the checkpoint. With this, it's like a shooter. One death, you know, and then you go back
you
to the checkpoint.
You are effed.
Yeah, so, I mean, so they did change that. They made it, but there are still these sort of instant death moments, aren't there? Certain weaponry... or certain bosses,
certain
or whatever,
enemies.
If they come into contact
they
with
take
you.
Away more than just one hit. They'll take away three, take away five.
And then, yeah, and some just take it all away, I think, pretty much, or it, certainly effectively. So, yeah, but that's kind of interesting that they went a little bit away from the sort of pure, the almost arcade shooter style for the home version. But one thing I noticed about it that's a bit of a problem, possibly because, obviously, this is sort of shoehorned onto the game after the fact, is that what will happen is, if you go through a level, you're not particularly worried about certain enemies hitting you and taking one or two points away, because you know by the time you get to the boss will kill you in one hit. So it doesn't matter whether you get there with two pieces of energy or five.
Yeah.
So you may as well just walk through the beginning of the level like you don't care, and then... And because the actual outcome is the same anyway, so that is one of the I agree with Johnny. It's distasteful to be killed in one hit. You know, that sort of real cynical quarter munching arcade style. But on the other hand, when you just put this system on top of it, you get this sort of dysfunctional situation that's not really ideal.
I think if the game is a one hit kill game and you go into it knowing that, okay, fine, but there shouldn't be enemies in a game that has distinctly made itself not one-hit kill that do that. Because not only is it...
It is unusual.
Not only does it feel like it's a sudden difficulty spike, it just makes the game feel unfair.
And sometimes it's not immediately apparent, you know. I mean, for instance, if someone has got a very broad sword that they slash, well, you think, well, yeah, I can see that kills you in one hit. A guy that spins a stick...
Yeah, those guys.
Doesn't look immediately as lethal, and yet
sticks
apparently
are dangerous.
You know? I haven't gotten that far, but I completely disagree with James here. I think
you're wrong.
Why I think that the variation in attack strength of the enemies gives you a nice tier of what do I need to be paying attention to on the screen.
I'm not saying there can't be variation, but one hit kills doesn't count as variation. It counts as rape.
That is a variation.
It is
among
a raping
others.
Variation.
I think when you get a custom, well, as we say, it depends on your point of view, because everything killed you originally. So,
yes.
I mean, I think the way the game's designed...
I don't have a problem with it. Those are the enemies I watch out for the most, you know?
Yeah, I think when you haven't got this thing of, like, it renders the other parts of the game irrelevant, it's which it does in certain parts, like the second level, just the second level after one of the checkpoints, walk in a straight line, because if they touch you three times, four times, doesn't matter, you won't die, and you'll get to the boss, and then if he touches you, you'll die anyway. So it renders that part of the level irrelevant. You just press forward.
Well, that's not really true, Greg, because you still have to kill the enemies to get the power-up, so you'll be ready to fight the boss.
That's somewhat true. I mean, I guess there's that, but the point is you don't have to dodge. You just could just press the button every now
maybe
and again.
Maybe so, but that's all. I mean, that's a very specific case. Like, on a
it
given
is a specific
level,
case, but
true.
There are a number of areas where it's almost like that. Or say, for instance, you get so far... And then you said, well, I've got five left now, so I could just kind of brute force this last bit because I know what's coming after that. You know, it just shows the fact that it was not designed with that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, okay. a lot of the time you spend is just trying to find the next checkpoint.
Well, I mean, Castlevania is like that too. Yeah. A lot of old games are like that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing. I mean, compared to something like Castlevania, the jumping works very differently. You've got this floating... sort of crouchy tiger, hidden dragon, sort of super jump that you do a lot. So it doesn't lend itself to sort of tight platforming, and it doesn't give you that. You know, it's
more like Legend of Kage.
The level design is not designed in that in mind. At times the level design is almost more like a brawler level design, mm-hmm, you know, and then you've got that one level where you just ascend up a cliff face. That's all you do, and that's
I haven't been there.
I think
either.
That might be the fifth level. That is not that good, shall we say.
Certainly, it's more of an action game, and it's more an action game, and maybe even more of a shooter than it is a platformer.
Yeah, exactly, and that was like the closest thing to platforming that I've seen. Really,
yeah,
is that bit, and also I suppose. There was a part where I'm not sure where you got to. Anyone's got to this, but there's a part where you can, you can jump onto the ceiling and you kind of move between the two, along the ceiling and the floor. So that's probably the most interesting part with the platform, because what you got these guys that like shoot out what kind of look like grappling hooks or something, and they kill you instantly. So you're kind of just switching between the two. The ceiling of the floor to avoid those, and so that's the most platform centric part of the game that I've played for sure. And then you've got the bit where you just jump up the cliff face vertically, and that's bad in my opinion. It's just boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if you compare it to the obvious point of comparison would be Ninja Gaiden, and I mean Ninja Gaiden is definitely more of a platformer, and I mean famously, mm-hmm, you know, it's got all these cheap enemy attacks while you're in midair, and there's a lot of jumping back and forth on walls. I mean, it makes you feel more like a ninja doing all that stuff, but at the same time, it's sort of less combat-oriented, I guess. Like, I don't know. Sure. I mean, and I think this is simpler than even the first Ninja Gaiden, but it's a lot faster and a lot less frustrating.
Mm, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things about it. You look at it graphically, technically, it's the movement and everything is very kind of limited, very kind of 8-bit. But much like a lot of the sort of TG-16, the what it made famous was shooters. And because it could move a lot of stuff around pretty fast, well, very fast compared to the 8-bit consoles. And that's what this does, because there are times when there are a lot of enemies on screen, and it will slow down here or there, but it generally performs quite well. I guess the only issues with that is that you notice in a game like this, where you've got, you know, humanoid enemies and all that, rather than just floating ships, that the animation isn't there. You know, mm-hmm, that's the thing. That's why I think TG-16 was so well suited to shooters, is that it could move a lot of stuff about, but just not stuff that itself was very fluid or detailed. And yeah, in a game like this, that shows up more. So it seems more like an 8-bit game on steroids or something.
Yeah, well, that's what the TurboGrafx-16 was. I mean, it had an 8-bit CPU, so
I think with stuff like, you know, your Gunheads or your Superstar Soldiers, that wasn't as apparent because it was a shooter, and whereas with this, it's very much apparent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm not an expert at all on TG-16, but of the few games that I've downloaded on Virtual Console and the other ones that I've seen, I don't think I've ever seen like a humanoid character that looks good on TG-16. And there are a few on Super Nintendo, maybe Genesis, and even the only one on NES I'd say is Punch-Out. You know, other than that, no.
China Warrior?
TG-16 yes! wasn't really... I think TG-16 just wasn't really up to displaying
that wasn't its
good
forte.
Human-like animation, or maybe they just weren't concerned with it.
By the way, can I go ahead and put China War in the nomination for our next title?
Oh, no way, man.
You may not.
Unless there's a secret Super NES version.
Oh, that's awful. But
even if you look at Ease, like Ease 1 and 2, Ease Book 1 and 2 for Turbo CD, which is on Virtual Console.
And got a 10 in EGM as well, by the way.
Did it really?
Yes, it did.
I'd say more deserved than Ninja Spirit, although still not.
Yeah, because, I mean, the CD games are a little different, you know, but I mean, you got stuff like Dracula X, which is a CD game, which is definitely much more
Ecstatic.
Impressive than Ninja Spirit, but it was many, many years older in addition to, many years further down the line than
Technology
Ninja Spirit
had moved
was.
On
not really compared light with light there.
Well, I mean, I have played, I did a Virtual Console recommendation once for like Splatterhouse on Turbo 16. Mm. And Ninja Spirit is definitely more technically impressive than that.
Hey, please tell me you recommended no.
Splatterhouse is awful.
That's
awful.
A brawler.
Yeah.
Awful. And again, I mean, this was the other thing that the TG16 was really famous for, apart from shooters, was, you know, quote-unquote arcade-perfect versions of games, which, of course, they were not at all arcade-perfect. But if you were lucky, they were actually really good.
They were arcade-playable.
Something like R-Type. You know, R-Type is not arcade-perfect, but it's very good, and obviously vastly superior to the Master System version or whatever.
Well, and especially, I mean, the NES didn't really have good shooters. None.
No.
Even the really well designed ones ran like shit.
Yeah,
precisely. So it was a sort of revelation in that sense.
Yeah, the hardware just wasn't ready for that.
Yeah,
and so right. With this, I think you've got some of the same, you know, a lot of the same things. You know, like I said, the action's pretty fast paced. You've got a lot of things. You'll have enemies shoot out a lot of projectiles, you know, simultaneously and things like that, which you can block and all. Yeah, so it's busy. Yeah, it's definitely really quite busy compared to games, other console games of its era.
All right, well, let's get into a few forum comments. There haven't been a whole lot yet, although it's only been, as of recording, it's only been a few days since the previous episode went online, so maybe some people just haven't had time yet to play it. But it did win a lot of votes, so I'm hoping if you voted for the game, and maybe if you didn't, if you voted for something else, you will check this out and play along with us. I mean, I'm definitely enjoying it and think it's worth my money so far. So
yeah, it's definitely good.
I would recommend that you play along with us. I think a lot of people would like this. And I mean, it felt to me, it felt like the first kind of Risk, other than when I knew I wasn't going to like Super Ghouls and Ghosts and I paid for it anyway. But other than that, I mean, this was the gamble. Like Greg said, I wasn't familiar with this game at all. And I went ahead and downloaded it anyway because it won the poll, and I've been pretty happy with it so far. So, I mean, if you're willing to put down $6 to check it out, I think you'll probably be happy with it. Not everybody, as we'll see. But Voodoo was the guy on the forums who originally nominated this, and he had not played it at the time either. So he's now playing it for the first time as well. But Voodoo says, "The game is a little more old school than I had anticipated, but I'm enjoying it very much. After getting stuck on the boss of the second level for quite some time, I checked the operation guide and discovered that you have 3 other weapons at your disposal. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, a whole new game opened up, one with lots of exciting possibilities." Now, let me pause here. I mean, we didn't really talk about the different kinds of weapons yet, yeah. But I think that's the coolest part of the game, for sure.
Yeah.
And because the difference is from other games of its type, I suppose, is that they're not the sub-weapons or anything. These are the weapons, your primary weapon that are different.
Yeah, and you can switch between them whenever you want to. You can upgrade them separately, and some of them play a fair bit differently after you upgrade them. You know, I mean, it changes how effective they are, it changes how you use them. So I think that's definitely what really sets the game apart from something that might otherwise be really generic. All right, well, getting back to Voodoo's post, even though it's a 16-bit game, I don't really see anything here that couldn't be done on the original NES. The animations are extremely limited. The walking animation for your character looks to be about 2 frames. The music is pretty basic. There are a good number of enemies on screen at the same time, which is fairly impressive for 1990. It's a fun game, and I don't regret playing it, but it hasn't held up as well as some other games from the time.
Well, certainly, I mean, what couldn't be done is the number of enemies on screen, as we've said.
And that is sort of integral to the game.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's more important for gameplay. I mean, that's the really important thing, you know, whether they sort of don't look terribly realistic as they walk it along isn't that important. So, I mean, that is the big separating factor. With the weapons, I have, in the end, tended to play more with the sword because it feels like that was it's the most balanced.
That's how the game was designed.
Yeah, it was primarily designed around that weapon being used.
Yeah.
There are some cases where the use of other weapons is simply too good to turn down. There's a boss at the sixth stage at the end where you have to fight multiple of these sort of undead sword wielding things, and because there's like 3 of them and they've got a pretty broad reach and you'll be killed instantly if they get you, you need to clear them out fast, and that's where if you've got the upgraded bombs is a huge advantage because they are very powerful.
Now, have you guys been using the rapid fire button that is on pretty much every TurboGrafx game?
Yeah, not typically. No.
I only used it to beat the second boss. And I use the sword, actually. I spam the second boss with the sword.
Yeah,
he's the guy who crawls around in the trees and kills you.
Yeah, the second boss is actually very similar to like bosses in Donkey Kong Jungle Climber. Because they kind of like that's what you obviously you're sort of climbing around as well is the difference.
Yeah.
But yeah, I beat him the same way. That's one of the better bosses for sure. That is quite a cool
boss. Well, it's unusual, for sure. It's memorable.
It's much more interesting than a lot of the other ones in this game and a lot of the ones that would populate games at the time. I mean, in stark contrast, I think the third boss is one of the worst bosses I've played.
Is that the big guy with the sword?
Very easy.
Yeah, oh, it's abysmal. I mean, it's a 15-foot-tall ninja.
Yeah.
With that moves incredibly slowly.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then you just jump over him and then rinse and repeat. It's rubbish. There's no merit in that. It looks ridiculous. And it plays terribly. I mean, it's just appalling.
Totally inconsistent. But I mean, think about, you know, look at the bosses in Ninja Gaiden. They're all bad. You basically just run up to it and stab it. And then when it gets close to the wall, you climb over. Like, you beat them all the same way. Most of them, the best... And this is a bit in the early Castlevania games, too. A lot of times, the best strategy is to run at it and hit it before it can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a race.
It's a race to see if you can push the button fast enough that it dies. And, you know, I think that's generally, from what I've seen so far, not the case with Ninja Spirit. So I think some of these bosses are more thought out than that. Some of them obviously are not.
Yeah, I mean, that one's particularly bad. There's one, there's a whole level where people are on sort of like kites. And there's one where you get sort of a bunch of people in formation on a kite, which is kind of fun. Bit hit and miss with the bosses for me. I mean, was it this one where you've got a bunch of shifting blocks, which is a little strange. You get some weird collision detection issues with that. So that's kind of a bit problematic as well. And then this boss I was mentioning before, with that it's just multiple enemies that you fought before, but just together that you have to use the bombs on. Not great.
Yeah, I hate bosses like that where they just completely rehash what they've done before. It's so lazy.
They just spawn in a bunch of stuff from before.
Well, that's pretty much what they do in the Conduit. Well, they don't really have bosses in the Conduit except the very end.
I mean, really, I could go on at length about that, but I'll...
totally off topic, my bad.
Yeah.
So, a dad posted in the forums, my favorite bit of the game was the boss who chases you up and down the trees in the forest level. That's level 2. Aside from that, though, I didn't find there to be much memorable about this game, perhaps the explanation for the lack of a sequel. The TG16 generally feels like a halfway point between generations, and this game similarly works as a mid-generation bridge between Ninja Gaiden and Shinobi. Now, I don't know that much about Shinobi. Are you guys more familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
It's another side-scrolling ninja game. I mean...
Yeah.
And that appeared in the arcades, and then the home version was somewhat different. And that's the difference.
Some pseudo 3D areas.
This is very faithful to the arcade, right? This PC Engine version.
Yeah,
Whereas Ninja Gaiden and Shinobi were changed considerably.
Ninja Gaiden had to be the arcade game wouldn't have run.
Yeah,
I mean, arcade game looks more like Super Nintendo. So
yeah, exactly. I think it's a similar thing with Shinobi as well, because that went to the Master System or something. You know, so obviously.
Yeah, and odds are, from how he describes, he's talking about Genesis Shinobi. Actually, you know, I can kind of see where he's saying it's kind of a mid console. But I don't know that this game is the best representation of what the TG16 is capable of.
Well, obviously, though, didn't have all the add-ons.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, it's kind of like that with the TG16, the original TG16 was not the same as the Turbo Duo. The Turbo Duo had more RAM. They could do a lot more with it.
Yeah.
So those games like Gate of Thunder... Well beyond anything was ever on.
Yeah, the CD stuff, and then of course the super graphics. I mean, that's the thing. You look at the version of Ghouls and Ghosts that I've got. I mean, the animation is breathtaking compared to Ninja Spirit.
Yeah,
you know, so it does kind of actually reveal the upgrade there somewhat.
And of course, Genesis would eventually follow that same doomed path.
much worse.
Yeah.
Add-ons.
Well, I suppose so.
All right. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just going to go on a bit about some of the level sort of issues. I mean, I don't know very much about Ninja Gaiden, but there's not a whole lot of level design going on, if you know what I mean. It seems like it's supposed to rely primarily on the combat.
Yeah, it reminds me of Kung Fu on the NES, in a way. Some of those levels.
I was thinking Kid Nicky a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of NES games.
Kid Nicky's actually really fun.
Radical.
I found that the level design in Ninja Spirit, it seems... as playing through it, I found that I generally avoid jumping, because it seems like it's a little harder to control where I'm going and where I'm aiming when I jump.
Mm.
It's a little easier to deal with the enemies when I'm just on the ground going left and right. But because there's all this platform stuff, once you have enemies who kind of shoot in from off the screen, you know, they kind of launch at you. When you get, for instance, when you're going through the third level and you have these dogs who are launching at you all the time, the fact that there are trees and little platforms around kind of affect how the dogs come in, because sometimes they land on the platform. Sometimes you need to jump out of the way of the dog and you can land on the tree and then you have to get back down to the ground or whatever. So it's pretty minor stuff, but I mean, it does play differently than if that stuff wasn't there at all.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it does seem to be a certain amount of vertical real estate that's redundant, doesn't there? But then, I mean, in terms of, like you said, there's a sort of one layer of sort of platforms with you would use. But then sometimes there's another layer, which I just don't really see what you'd be doing up there, to be honest.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that in Legend of Kage 2 on DS. And right. Unfortunately, I think there's kind of a lot of that in Muramasa, the Demon Blade.
Really?
Yeah, from E3, I mean, James, did you see this at E3?
Yeah.
It seemed like there was a lot of upper-level stuff in the levels that you just really didn't need.
Yeah, I guess. There's usually stuff up there you could get to, and just things you could go find. But yeah, it wasn't really all that necessary.
I guess it'll be interesting to see if having played through Ninja Spirit will inform our thoughts on Muramasa when it comes out later this summer.
There are, in terms of the whole aerial combat kind of thing, I think later on in the game it does force you into the air more, or it behooves you to go into the air more and use that. You know, because you get, like I said, you get these enemies coming in on kites. You'll get waves of those spinny stick of death guys coming along, which kind of it's easier to jump over them and then deal with them after that and things like that. So as it goes on, you won't be, you know, won't so much be jumping by choice, but you know, that comes into play more, and that is pretty fun, I think, especially when you've got the option guys, because they manipulating them is kind of, you know, you could almost like create a shield with them against like the spinny stick guys, or you know, almost like leave them in the air to block all the projectiles coming in while you kind of make progress and things. So that's where the whole having the crazy jump thing kind of pays off, because as you say, there are sections of the game where you don't really want to jump at all. So it's like, well, what is the point of having this bizarre lofty jump if that's the case? But it does kind of come into play.
Okay, well, to wrap up the forum comments this week, Golden Phoenix posted, "It has been a couple of months since torturing myself with this game, but I recall the majority of the levels are pretty standard in that you move forward and slash slightly different colored enemies. Boss fights may have three different ways of attacking, max. The game was so uninspired and boring, I really cannot remember more than a couple of the boss fights, and those two I remember because they were extremely tedious and boring." So, she is not a fan of Ninja Spirit.
I think with my this game to me is very mediocre, I think. There's nothing particularly bad about it apart from that boss fight that I was referring to.
There's nothing particularly great about it either.
But yeah, it's kind of,
I agree,
it's kind of not particularly substantial, and yeah, there's things about the core gameplay is pretty fun. But like I said, that some of these issues, like the way the hit system is kind of a bit fudged, and the fact that it feels a bit like a brawler, which I'm not that big of a fan of brawlers in general. You know, I think it's a decent game, and obviously I think it's fair to say that it was much more impressive at the time, which kind of give it more of an allure probably than we can sort of perceive now.
It just shows me how little patience I have for games of this type nowadays. I'm just like, this is so pointless. Beating this proves nothing. You know,
because it's just boring.
You know,
before it was central to your self esteem.
Exactly. I'd be like, I beat
Ninja
Spirit.
There's no achievement unlocked at the end.
Yeah. Exactly.
You've got to tweet in the deal nowadays. What's in it for me?
But it's just one of those games that seems just kind of artificially hard. You know?
Well, certainly if you had the one hit entirely.
Oh, yeah, that would be.
And I mean, the thing about that that's really harsh is that when you've got the multiple guys on screen, you know, the multiple versions of you with the shadow things, and I mean, he is really busy, and like one stray little bomb or something, it would be so easy. I mean, that to me is just ridiculous.
Bullet hell, that's what it's like. It's like a bullet hell brawler.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, how many brawlers have one-hit kills? I mean, you know, like, imagine Final Fight if that was the case.
It's an odd little game, that's for sure.
It's a mixed bag, Johnny.
I am enjoying it. I mean, I don't think it's amazing. I'm definitely with you guys. I mean, I think it is sort of more on the mediocre side. Mm. But at the same time, I'm enjoying it. And maybe it's just because I kind of like this kind of game, this sort of fast action game like this. I mean, it's not a shooter. It's not nearly as difficult as your average shoot 'em up. And yet, it's a lot faster paced than a brawler, which is, again, I'm with Greg. I mean, I'm usually not a big fan of brawlers, but I feel like the enemies die so much faster here in the
That's
game,
true.
And they get thrown at you so much faster.
This is a good point, because what I dislike most about those games is the attrition of it. You know, where you're just standing there and beating on the same guys, and you know, whereas that isn't a factor. It's much more fast-paced, and that does make it far more pleasing. And there really isn't any moments like, you know, in a Castlevania game, there'll be a bit where it's like, okay, so I'm going to jump on this platform, and then you've got to wait for it slowly sort of cross an abyss or something. You know, there's none of that in this. I mean, it's bang, 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 bang. You know, apart from the stupid level where you have to jump up the cliff face, which is incredibly slow. You know, it's pretty much, you know, constant action.
Yeah, this game, it's very arcade. Very arcade.
You can make a bold comparison here. It's definitely not as good, but I think there's a lot of similarity here with Gunstar Heroes in the way that you're just constantly moving forward, shooting dudes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess.
You know, kind of like Gunstar Heroes with not as good, you know, the bosses.
Yeah,
That's a major part of that game.
Yeah,
and there's no co-op. But like it to me, it does feel a lot like Gunstar Hero.
Gunstar Zero.
And I mean, I'd say the weapons are not. You haven't got the weapon combinations. You know, those. You have got the different selectable weapons.
You just can't combine them.
They're not as well balanced or as interesting as the ones in Gunstar Heroes. That's for sure. But yeah, it's a good comparison, I think, because there's not that much stuff like Gunstar Heroes before Gunstar Heroes, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Other than Contra,
you got like stuff like Contra, but.
That's a bit
Gunstar
different.
Heroes has gone a completely different level and has a different tone and everything. And I don't know, to me, this is more like Gunstar Heroes than Contra.
No, I could definitely see that for sure. So in that sense, the core gameplay of it can sort of appeal to me. The difference being, of course, that Gunstar Heroes is definitely nothing approximating a one-hit kill in that. You've got a pretty sort of continuous energy bar.
Well, and there's just so much more depth, too.
Yeah,
there's a lot more shit on the screen.
I mean, that's the thing. We say this is busy. I mean, Gunstar Heroes really takes things up a notch several years later.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week. I don't know how much we'll be talking about it next week, but we will certainly be open to reading some more forum comments if there are more. So if you are playing along with this, or if you haven't yet, but you intend to, hurry up and get over to the forum thread and keep the discussion going. I think there's more to be said about this game, like it or hate it, and we'd like to keep it going next week. So, we're going to take another break now and come back for a quick listener mail segment. Everybody, we're back to wrap up the show with listener mail, and Greg has the very first one.
All right, this is from B-Boy, and he writes, "This is a little late, but you guys may be pleased to hear that because of your awesome Super Metroid special, I got it on Virtual Console, and it's now one of my favorite games of all time. Now I have Zero Mission, and I plan to get the Prime Trilogy in August. Thanks to your guys' show, I've discovered my second favorite franchise after Zelda." That actually does kind of make it all worth it, I will say.
that's awesome to hear. It's hard to believe there are people who've
not
never played Metroid.
That did not sound sincere. So
it was entirely sincere.
I know. It's hard to sound sincere at that time.
It's very difficult for me to be sincere, apparently, but yeah, it does. Because the point is there was a lot of preparation and effort that went into that episode in pre-production, recorded itself, post-production. If one person discovers Metroid through this, then it definitely is all worth it.
Yeah.
So I'll get on to the next part of the question. What do you guys think of a return of Square to Nintendo? There was always some Enix support on Nintendo systems, but do you think it's possible we could see the return of the true Final Fantasies, particularly with the new Kingdom Hearts coming to DS? Personally, I hope that the need to remake games will overcome them enough that we maybe see an FF7 remake on DS. Do you guys think this could ever happen?
No, it'll never happen. There will never be a Final Fantasy VII remake on a Nintendo system. Ever.
Nope.
Well, probably not, because Sony has the publishing rights.
Well, not just that. That game is inextricably linked with the PlayStation brand.
And also, well, I mean, do you think that if they were going to do an FF7 remake, a lot of the point of it would be like, yeah, to be the maximum like epic kind of scope. Yeah.
I mean, the original Final Fantasy VII looks kind of like a DS game.
Yeah.
The graphics were primitive, really, so that would be the point. It's like it was FF7, but the graphics aren't primitive anymore, you know?
Yeah, the idea would be to do a high-res... I mean, because there was some great art direction in that game. It outstripped the technology in play. So,
yeah.
If you're going to remake that game, you're going to want to remake it in a world where you can actually fully realize the vision.
Well, it just came out on PlayStation Network, so you can get it on PS3 and play it on your PSP for like $10. And, yeah. You know, if I owned one of those platforms, I might do it, because I probably would never play all the way through it again. But for $10, it'd probably be worth the 10 or 20 hours I'd put into it and reliving those memories.
Yeah.
But
it's such a great game.
I wouldn't play it on DS, really. I mean, it'd be nice to have it portable, I guess. But, yeah, I mean,
it already is.
It would be a pretty direct conversion over to DS. Like, so, I don't know. It's the way that B-Boy phrased this question is odd. Like, what do you think of a return of Square to Nintendo? Because I thought that happened like five years ago.
Well, he means a mainline Final Fantasy title.
Yeah, well, we all get in main... Well, I'm sure Square Enix, you know, we all get in the mainline Dragon Quest on...
Right, and
well,
in
two
Japan,
mainline
that's
Dragon
a,
Quest
that's
games.
A,
so. Mm-hmm.
That's a much bigger deal in Japan than it is here.
Yeah, but it kind of begs the question, is that some of the little split that they're doing, how they're allocating things, you know, mainline Dragon Quest is going to the Nintendo systems while mainline Final Fantasy, as we already know, 14 is coming, will be the online one or whatever. Both of those will be on the HD consoles.
Well, mm-hmm. and not just that, Sony is still kind of, I'm going to use quotes here, the lead platform in Japan for the Final Fantasy franchise.
Yeah.
It's the only one that's getting Final Fantasy
yes,
13
exactly.
in Japan. I mean,
and,
not that the 360 is that relevant.
And 14, they say, is exclusive to PS3.
They've not jobbed Microsoft either. Microsoft is getting these exclusive new franchises that, you know, one-offs from Square.
Yeah,
The Last Remnant.
Project
stuff Sylph, like that.
The Last Remnant.
Infinite Undiscovery.
Infinite Undiscovery. Right.
Yeah.
So really, they are leveraging all three... manufacturers.
Oh yeah, because I mean they are putting out a lot of stuff on Nintendo systems, mm-hmm. as Johnny discussed last week with the new Final Fantasy Gaiden.
I mean, it's easy to dismiss maybe the remakes on DS or the some of the previous Crystal Chronicles stuff, because a lot of it was very convoluted to play, or it's all multiplayer focused, so it doesn't feel like real Final Fantasy. But I mean, the Crystal Bears is really the fruit of it's really kind of what a lot of us wanted from this partnership to begin with, which is that Square would make like a real Final Fantasy game for a Nintendo console and really put a lot of production into it. And I mean, Crystal Bear is definitely a different kind of a game than Final Fantasy, but it is a single player, probably some kind of epic thing with a grand story, and you can't say that about any of the other Crystal Chronicles games. So it seems like, I don't know if they're reorienting Crystal Chronicles to be more like the main Final Fantasy series, but at least they've expanded it to include that possibility.
I would say the Crystal Chronicles is now almost its own franchise. I mean, they've essentially
they've even got spin-offs.
Yeah,
of
they've essentially
the WiiWare stuff.
Branched the thing into so many types of gameplay now that effectively it isn't a game. It's like it could almost drop the Final Fantasy if Final Fantasy weren't worth so much money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, I definitely understand the desire to have like a mainline Final Fantasy game on a Nintendo console, and clearly that's not happening for a long time.
No.
But you have to realize that kind of thing doesn't happen on any platform very often. I mean, FF12 came out 4 years ago, and it's still going to be another year before we get 13.
Well, delayed, and 12 was delayed multiple times.
And so, I mean, if you're going to break it, if you're going to get so specific that you say, I won't be satisfied with Square support on Nintendo until we get a mainline Final Fantasy game, I mean, PS3 doesn't have a mainline Final Fantasy game yet.
No.
Xbox 360 doesn't either.
Well, it has 11, if you want to count
they
that.
They have something coming next year. But all I'm saying is that if the only Square game that you care about is the next numbered Final Fantasy game, you're not going to be happy except every 5 years. these are super expensive games to make, and they're just not going
to
make them very often.
Yeah, on whatever happens to be the most expensive console at the time as well.
Exactly, because they're going to go for the highest production values. And the great thing about Dragon Quest series is that they don't care about that stuff. And that's why they can do things like put it on DS and
Wii. It's funny because it feels almost like Square and Enix have such radically different perspectives on game design that their merger, although it was done out of necessity, is kind of a freak job. I mean, the company that's come out of it is almost bipolar.
Well, but it lets them diversify things, though, doesn't it? Quite nicely, as I said.
Yeah, it does, but I mean...
You can tend sort of multiple fields at once.
There's a certain lack of vision that came out of... or at least a consistent vision that came out of this combined company.
Well, I mean, I think Square Enix has other consistency issues right now than just...
Well,
I mean, one thing I will say, you know, I mean, with the Final Fantasy Gaiden game for DS, I mean, that sounds almost like a bit like a Mega Man 9 kind of thing that they're doing. I mean, it's not quote-unquote mainline or the next numbered game, but it is like an original Final Fantasy that's, you know, as if it was slotting somewhere in the old, you know, the progression.
Yeah, but his frame of reference, at least based on the email, is 7. And I don't think that that's sort of a regressive
step.
Yeah,
possibly.
Seven,
but I'm just I suppose the point is, for some people, just original content that is very much in the spirit of the mainline games would be something they want. And that is coming with that game.
Most people know that the Final Fantasy series, the main Final Fantasy series, had a huge shift at 7.
Yes.
So, I mean, 1 through 6 Massive. Are one thing. 7 through 13 are something very different. And, you know, what I'm saying is, if 7 is, like, your favorite or the one that you came into the series with, and that's what you're looking... If you're looking for a follow-up to 7, you should buy a different console, because it's not coming to Wii. I mean, that's just not what they're interested in. I don't think Square is going to make any old-fashioned, linear, hardcore Japanese RPGs for Wii, because... I mean, they haven't shown any inclination to do that so far, and I don't see why they're going to change that now.
Well, furthermore, I mean, Nintendo as a company has gone away from what Square Enix is doing as a company. Really.
Well,
the Enix side of it, but Square side of it, definitely.
I just want to say that, you know, to B-Boy, I too am I'm a big fan of the Final Fantasy series. I'm also a big fan of the Dragon Quest series. And if you have a Wii, your intent to play games on the Wii, you really want RPGs on the Wii, don't ignore Dragon Quest X. I mean, it's still a big mystery. We don't know anything about it, but it is coming out at some point. And, I mean, assuming that they don't make any crazy dramatic changes, which is about the last thing I would expect from a Dragon Quest game, it is a lot like Final Fantasy in how it plays. It may look very different. It may have, you know, a lot more lighthearted feel to it. But if you like that RPG gameplay, you like the 100-hour games and stuff like that, Dragon Quest X is almost assuredly going to be that, and it's coming to Wii. And it's going to look awesome, I can guarantee that. If you're into the graphics, I mean, it's going to max out Wii graphics for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 8 did on PS2. So, I don't know if you're familiar with Dragon Quest games, a lot of people aren't, but if you're way into Final Fantasy and you haven't given Dragon Quest a chance, I'd say do that, because we do have a major, huge Japanese RPG coming to Wii down the line, and that's Dragon Quest X.
We also have, which is somewhat different, but if the production values things is what you like, there's also
Monster Hunter.
Yeah, Monster Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
coming to Wii, which could be closer to what you would expect from a Final Fantasy game, although the gameplay is substantially different.
Mm-hmm. It's more of a boss rush.
Yeah.
Okay, so James has the next letter.
So Scott writes, "More and more frequently, I see articles discussing how well a game sold in its first few days after release, then declaring that a game is a success or failure based on that information. That may be an okay indicator for extremely high-profile games, but personally, I buy most of my games well after the release date. Especially with the expanded audience on the Wii and DS, I suspect there are quite a few people who don't keep up with when each game is coming out, but will pick it up later when they see it on the shelf. Do you think the opening weekend mentality is appropriate for the games industry? I realize that shelf space is a concern, but I feel like games that don't immediately sell huge amounts are being rotated out so quickly now that it becomes far too easy for lower-profile games to get lost in the shuffle. Can anything be done about this problem, or do we just have to deal with it until retail finally disappears?"
Great question.
Yeah, I mean, that is where it comes from, isn't it? I mean, that's why people in the gaming media or analysts or whatever pay what you might consider to be undue attention to early numbers, is because of the expectation that that's what retail will base its decision making off. You know, that they you know that their shelf space is precious, and if something doesn't seem to be moving very quickly, they'll move it off themselves. So,
well, that's a big factor, Greg. But there are other things that go into this mentality. I mean, part of it is that...
Well, it's instant gratification kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the gaming media is really obsessed with release schedules and what's the newest thing. And so, basically, once this thing drops off the top 10 list, it doesn't exist to us anymore. Because we're moving on to the next thing. You know, we want to know what games came out this month, the next month. And the other thing is, part of it is the way the NPD numbers are let out, because, you know, the public the numbers that they basically they don't leak out, but they give out to the public for discussion, only have the top 10 for each month.
For each
and
system.
For
each system, yeah, with somewhat less, you don't know how many units they sold per system.
Yeah.
On the system specific list.
But when major title A isn't in that top 10, you can assume it didn't do well.
No, you can't. You can assume it did less well than the top 10, but,
yes, but
that doesn't mean it was a failure. And the thing is, we just don't have the data to discuss game sales beyond the top 10.
Well,
so
you know,
it's not really our fault.
There's
you know?
A very interesting example here, and that's Carnival Games. Because Carnival Games didn't crack the top 10 for a while, and then it wouldn't go the hell away. You know, it just sat around for a while and sold a bajillion copies.
I don't know whether it ever really necessarily penetrated the highest reaches of the chart, but the point is, you know, it just kept ticking along at those numbers that obviously relative to its development cost, it was a very profitable enterprise, and I guess that's very much the thing with Wii and DS. I mean, you've got different sort of phenomena here, haven't you? Because you've got the first thing, you've got the top tier, you've got your Mario Kart Wiis and all that are showing that you can get in the top 10 months and months afterwards, or years afterwards, even in some cases. Or, you know, the case of something like Professor Layton for the DS, you can have this sort of renaissance if they remarket you. You know, it seems like there is a bit of a difference now with retailers. I think they probably do think, you know, that things can sell even if they're not new, but there have to be certain things that go into that.
Well,
in the first place.
And
you know, like, for instance, if Nintendo's giving it its backing, you know, like with remarketing a game or, you know, something like Rhythm Heaven, you know, which gets marketed heavily in the first place, they're more likely to kind of stick with it than they otherwise would be.
And part of the reason this happens is that the sales age mentality is more geared around the old way of doing things, which is, you know, Xbox, PS2, even GameCube to some extent, and then now carried over into the high-definition systems. For a game like, say, Devil May Cry 4, okay? Very expensive game to produce.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 months of sales for that game are extremely important, because the price is going to come down on it very fast. And if it doesn't sell well in the first couple of months, that game's going to lose money on development.
Well, an example of that is Bionic Commando. It's now $20.
Sure. Total failure. They're probably going to end up losing money in all.
Hand over
fist.
And
part of that, because it doesn't have the expanded audience appeal, it's not going to be able to sell as consistently months down the line. It will continue to sell. It probably, actually, sales will probably go up next month because the price has gone down so far.
Mm-hmm.
But that's balanced out by the fact that the company's not making nearly as much money as it was the first month.
Yeah.
So these publishers want to sell as many copies as possible right off the bat, because they know that game's price is going to drop. And when it does and it gets reordered, they're not going to make as much money down the line. The difference with Wii, and the reason that the opening weekend mentality doesn't apply as much to Wii as it does the other consoles, is the development costs are so low. So something like Boom Blocks, which never entered the top 10 and probably never entered the top 20 of all platform game sales, over time, even as the price got cut, the selling price was probably still high enough that they would still pay off the development costs and eventually make a profit.
Just last week, we were talking about Overkill, House of the Dead, and they were saying that, you know, the sales at the lower price were part of its, you know, it turned into profitability. So clearly, again, see that's viable, that end of the scale. Which is kind of a different thing from with Nintendo's ability to keep selling, because they keep doing it at full price. You know,
yes.
That's the thing. Yeah. They'll keep selling, you know, Mario Kart or any of this stuff at full price in perpetuity. Because, I mean, you know, Mario Kart didn't have the most spectacular opening, you know, by any means. I mean, nothing compared to Brawl in America anyway.
Well, Brawl was more of a short burn, you know,
yeah,
like short
Yeah, exactly. But now, look at it, you know. So, I mean, you've got that philosophy in the sense that, you know, even with the big games on Wii, you know, the ones that do have the hype, the pedigree, all that stuff, the opening weekend is mentality doesn't really apply in terms of what's going to sell the most over the long term. But then on the lower end, like your Boom Boxes and or even perhaps lower than that, the Carnival games, it doesn't apply either. So it's really kind of across the spectrum thing.
Well, the thing is, too, is that you can't forget that Nintendo is still selling a lot of consoles. So games like Brawl and Mario Kart Wii, they're still new to people.
Yeah.
If they get that perception in the minds of the public, but also retailers, you know, retailers think, well, you know, this is what we sell to people, you know, when they want to buy a system.
I guarantee that a game like Super Mario Galaxy is still selling really well in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't hear about that as...
We've sold more than a... It's definitely sold over 1 million units in the sort of the fiscal year after it was released.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still selling well, but it's just not selling as well as things like Wii Play and Wii Fit and Mario Kart. And that's the other thing about sort of what Nintendo has done. Not only have they lowered development costs, so you can make back your money over a longer period of time, even as prices get cut, but also they're... These evergreen first-party titles that they've got are such blockbusters. They shove other things off the top 10 list.
Yes.
So you've got games that are now in maybe 11 through 20 that a generation ago, with the same exact number of units sold, would have easily been near the top 10. So it's not that they're selling badly. They're just not selling as well as these ridiculous titles from Nintendo. Mm-hmm. They're still making money. They're still big hits. But we don't hear about them because we only get the top 10.
Even if you're talking about the format-specific top tens, you know, when you've got sort of Mario Kart and Wii Fit on the one hand, and then you might have, say, for instance, Mario Kart DS and New Super Mario Bros. On the DS, I mean, it's kind of like a top eight that you're trying to crack, really, because they've got these sort of monopolized because the hardware sales are still strong enough, and then these games get sold with the hardware with regularity.
Yes.
That means that they're just there, and you have to compete with that on the sales charts, but you don't really have to compete with that to make money.
And
I think that's the problem. That, you know, what Nintendo talked about getting away from the environment which the HD consoles are still in, or is it sort of, you know, on steroids, where, you know, the costs have gone up and up and up, and you've got to sell to people fast, so it's more incumbent on you to, you know, blitz with the marketing. So not only do people think, I want to buy this game at some point, I have to buy this game now, because everyone else is going to buy it now, and then we can all talk about buying it now, and, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, it's like, I mean, why do you think that 360 and PS3 games have collector's this, you know, all that kind of stuff at launch? You never see that with Wii games, because they don't need to do that.
Yeah, selling, you know, trying to essentially extract more money out of the hardcore early adopter crowd, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, it's price discrimination.
Well, and this also plays into the online strategies, especially of Microsoft, because if they pretty much require every game to have online functionality of some sort, it kind of pushes the audience to feel like, well, if I'm going to pick up Resident Evil 5 at all, it's best that I get it early on, because then I have more people to play it with.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, that's annoying.
Because Evergreen doesn't work too well with online titles.
No, it doesn't.
All right, well, John has the next question.
Okay, Junior Librarian from Washington writes, having never actually played any of the Metroid games, working on that at the moment, I may be completely wrong on this point, but I think that the person in the Samus suit that Samus is talking to could possibly have been killed. I'm assuming this is from Other M.
Mm-hmm.
Samus is talking to could possibly have been killed, and that is the main boss of the game, sort of like Mother Brain.
I don't completely understand the theory, but I mean, what he's referring to is this scene in the trailer where it looks like a young Samus, who's sort of in her blue Zero suit, is talking to another character who's wearing the power armor that Samus would normally be wearing.
It's funny, because I thought she was older. I could guess it just shows her different point of view.
It's the art style,
She was wearing a lab coat or something, wasn't it? It was just like... You know,
no, that's somebody else that she's talking to. I don't think that's her.
Is that... But that's the thing. It's really not clear what the hell's going on, basically. So
I think that trailer is probably intentionally really, really just cryptic.
Inscrutable.
Yeah. They want us to have this conversation.
And yeah, just ponder
and
what the hell.
It's fun to talk about these
and things. And, you know, you hear different things, so it could be... the idea that there's two of her, two of Samus in some form, you got parallel worlds, time travel...
No more parallel
cloning.
Worlds. I will not pick up another Metroid game with parallel worlds. Not again.
Never again.
No, the different kind of parallel worlds, not that kind. Not the purple kind.
Too soon. Too soon. All right. Well, yeah, it's just hard to say at this point. But
yeah. So Metroid's never gone that sci-fi with its stories, if you know what I mean.
Like, no, not at all.
But in that sense, you know, time travel and all that kind of craziness. Like, it's...
They've never done time travel.
The story's not normally that dense, so there's not really that
room for
it. Yeah,
they've never done time travel because the timeline itself is already convoluted.
Yeah.
Well, my first impression of seeing the Other M trailer was that Samus had a sister or something. Like, when I first saw Samus and she had this kind of shorter hair, she looked younger to me, but that may just be the
yeah, but
the
that's
artist.
Earlier in the trailer. The bit at the end seemed like it was an older one of herself.
Yeah, so I don't know. Sisters, that was my first thought was
it
sisters.
It seems to me, my first thought when I was watching it was that, you know, you were going to see her progress through her life to some extent, at least in the cutscenes. You know, you'd see her as a little
kid,
RPG. Maybe. When she was orphaned, and then you'd see her when she was a young adult, and then, you know, and so forth. So,
are you suggesting a montage in the opening sequence?
Yeah, maybe a montage, or maybe like it will be sort of a recurring flashback. So, you know,
now
I'm flashing back to my childhood. You know, you'll play for a while, and now I'm flashing back to when I was 10 years old.
So, a romp through Samus's psychological traumas, essentially.
It could well be. I mean, it could be. I mean, they've talked about getting more into the character.
Yeah, like more of the backstory is going to be involved from what they say.
And presumably, you know, it could sort of join back up at some point. You know, the flashbacks.
The whole game comes in the form of a therapy session. Everything's
this
flashbacks.
This is kind of, this is what concerns me about Other M, because I think the gameplay stuff that we've seen is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, and you know, you guys know this, but I don't care that much about the story. Well, I care, but I would, if I had my way, I would kind of leave it alone. I mean, I like knowing very little about Samus because I think that's part of what makes her cool. And I don't really want to know more about her backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, they've done the manga in Japan. Like, obviously there's an audience who does care, but that's not what I like about these games. I like them to be more mysterious and moody and solitary. And, you know, that was my least favorite thing in Corruption was all the damn talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think
cut
that's,
that shit out, dude.
I know, I have similar sympathies. I mean, I guess if it's done well, it's done well. I mean, if it's good, that can cross, you know.
It hasn't been done well yet in the series.
So that's the first challenge, and then
we know Team Ninja is known for their intricate story weaving.
Once again, I just kind of wonder, you know, I have that sort of Metroid Prime feeling where I just wonder how much of a Metroid game it's going to actually feel like.
No, I'm pretty confident in the game part, but it's just whether the story will kind of complement it well.
Look, if anybody says Sammy, I'm turning the game off. Seriously.
If somebody came up to me and said, "I'm going to make you a brand new, beautiful 2D Metroid game, but it's going to have a bunch of anime bullshit in it," I'd be like, "Okay, do it."
Yeah, if that's the price you pay.
If that's the price I pay, I mean, I'd rather not have a bunch of anime bullshit in it. But if it means I get to play 2D Metroid on the Wii, then yeah, do it.
Yeah. I mean, my beef with that is I feel like it'll kind of lose some of its flavor and style, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not gonna. It's not like it's gonna taint Super Metroid.
No,
anything,
you can't retroactively
go back in time. And just,
yeah, exactly.
It's gonna have dinosaurs in it. I
Zach
know it.
A 10. 10. Zach's just giving this game a 10.
That's right.
But and that's the thing. I suppose it was Super Metroid and Metroid Prime. They both did that so well. I mean, it is, you know, you wonder how many more times you can do it that well in terms of the sort of solitude, but some sort of unorthodox storytelling.
Yeah.
Like, if it's done well, I think you could accept it. I mean, that's the question. Is it going to be done well? I have no idea.
I think Sakamoto has a desire to be experimental with the story of Metroid. I mean, you see what he did in Fusion, and to a lesser extent with Zero Mission, in trying to tell some backstory of Samus, and I'm not surprised that he's going even further in that direction, or it seems like he is, with Other M. Because, I mean, he seems to be really into the character. which I don't care about. But he's also really into the level design and the stuff that makes it feel like Metroid gameplay wise. And so that's why I feel pretty good about Other M, because I know he's there. And he did Zero Mission, so as far as I'm concerned, he has carte blanche on the next Metroid game.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the final letter today is from frequent letter writer Mr. Vega from Texas, and he writes, I heard you need to calibrate Wii Motion Plus a ton to get it to work right. Is this something that can be fixed via firmware or more time and software programming? I worry that the benefits that Wii Motion Plus brings equal the negatives because of the constant calibration to work correctly. Greg, I defer to you. I think you're the only one of us who actually owns Wii Motion Plus.
Yeah, well, Tiger is not a good example for this issue because, of course, the action is not continuous.
Right.
And every time you're going to take a swing, you point the club down, then you press a button, all that. So it basically has convenient opportunities to recalibrate every time you're going to use it. So,
but you're not manually calibrating it.
No. The game does, you know, because it knows when you're starting, pointing down, and you do one stroke, and then you're not doing anything for a while, and then you do another stroke. I mean, it's just not. The problem comes, say, for instance, if you're doing something like the sword fighting game in Wii Sports Resort, and you're fighting for some sort of extended period, and after a while, it kind of the gyroscopic sensor kind of drifts. So that it's no longer mirroring your actions very closely at all. And that's the problem, because there isn't a convenient opportunity there necessarily to resync. And so I think how there's a couple of different ways that the main way they kind of talk about, you see, is, oh, okay, if it, in the manual for Wii Motion Plus, is you could just set the controller down for a while and let it sort of balance out. Basically, you're just letting the sensor kind of return to its position.
Well, gyroscopes by nature saturate, and they need to be offloaded after a while.
So that's kind of the thing they talk about in the manual and stuff. That if you feel there's a problem, just put it down for a while, and let it settle, and then go back, and then that should be all right. But there's also an issue if you're playing a really extended thing. People talk about, say, using it in Zelda or whatever, and maybe if you're in the middle of a boss fight, you'd be kind of loath to pause it and set it down and then unpause it or whatever. But there was some sort of quicker in-game calibration technique that uses the sensor bar somehow. If you're pointing at the screen, it can use that to sort of do it. So it doesn't have to be as obtrusive as actually putting it down on a flat surface and doing it that way. So the point is, you don't really know how annoying it could be for. There's so many different kinds of applications that it can be used for. It's kind of difficult to know. And maybe you can just, the game can introduce sly little opportunities for it to resync.
Yeah, I think, like, for instance, Red Steel 2, which is requiring Wii Motion Plus, is going to be fine because it has shooting in it. So, I mean, the whole point of the game is to kind of switch quickly between swinging the sword around and shooting at the screen. And so it should automatically, it should just immediately pick up the sensor bar and recalibrate while you're playing the game. So you shouldn't have to even think about it. You won't even know it's happening.
Well, and a lot of the Wii Sports Resorts mini games, from what we played, there are opportunities to calibrate in there. So in the archery mini game, that's one that was most dependent from what I saw on it. And what it does is, when you hold it out straight up and down, it's calibrating at that juncture.
Yeah, again, I mean, that's because archery is, it's not continuous, is it? So you wouldn't think it'd be very difficult, between shots.
Well, and also, Wii Sports is a mini game collection. I mean, you're not going to be playing any of these more than 5 minutes.
There are ways to do it, essentially. So there are ways to get around this with game design. There's not much they could do to patch it. I mean, it's a hardware situation, but
I think it's just inherent.
That part is, absolutely.
There will eventually be a Wii Motion Plus game where the developers don't take this into account, and it just drives you insane.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's shoddily done. I think it's probably inevitable. I mean, so the biggest concern, I suppose, would be, if you've got some sort of comprehensive implementation in a Zelda game, and for instance, because I think also it's harder to kind of shoehorn in these kind of calibration little moments because it kind of breaks the mood of the game more.
Yeah.
You know, if you put those in something like Wii Sports, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't make much of a difference, does it? Whereas, you know, if Zelda's supposed to be kind of epic and, you know, sort of you transport you to a fantasy world and all this sort of stuff, you know, having some message come on the screen or, you know, some other such thing, it would be extremely kind of obtrusive. So,
all right, well, I've got an idea. What if enemies in Zelda, after, you know, assuming there is even a sword in the new Zelda, which I guess is under scrutiny.
Yeah.
but let's say you have a big sword fight, the enemy's on the ground, they add a new element where you have to finish off the enemy or it will get back up and keep fighting you.
That would get really old after a while.
Well, maybe, but games have done this, so in order to finish off the enemy, you point the remote at the screen and shoot him. That's when it recalibrates.
And it wouldn't have to be every enemy. I mean, you wouldn't have to, you
exactly.
know, anything like that. You would only have to do, you wouldn't have
Space
to be that heavy-handed
out.
With it. But I think you make a good point in the sense
there's
always...
one idea.
There's always probably going to be some sort of way of incorporating it. It's dependent on a few things, therefore. Rigorously playtesting it to assess how often this is going to happen. And then the second part of it is just the sort of elegance and ingenuity with which you can sort of put in a little fix. So... It is going to probably come down, as James kind of alluded to, the quality of the developers, you know, and I think from Nintendo, especially as it is their hardware, you can have some pretty good level of confidence that they're going to work around it.
And every minigame in Wii Sports Resort, there was some mechanism for doing this.
Hopefully, most of the time, it'll be invisible.
Yeah, the only one that was really notable on was the fencing one. Where you had to point it at the screen and then press A.
Yeah, that's right. And then there's something I've heard, like, about pressing the D-pad in the middle of it can help or something.
When in the sword fighting, I think you can recalibrate it at any time by pushing down on the D-pad.
I'm not sure exactly how effective that is relative to being able to just point at the screen, but perhaps it does help somewhat.
The infrared calibration is an option. It's on by default, but you can turn it off if, for instance, you're playing in a room with a lot of infrared sources and you don't want it to recalibrate on the wrong place.
Exactly, yeah, because that can happen sometimes. Yeah. It's just a nightmare to play if you're in somewhere where the sensor bar just gets totally screwed up. So if you were relying on that to recalibrate, it would essentially uncalibrate it and just screw it up entirely.
But that's a concern with the Wii in general, where if you're in the middle of, you know, a room with a lot of sunlight coming in, you're pretty much
it's just not advisable to play your Wii in an area like that unless you're playing Geometry Wars or whatever.
Yeah, the conduit got me on that with the sun coming in the window. I mean,
that's wild. Mm.
I've navigated the Wii menu by pointing my remote at the oven. Works not well, but...
candles, ovens, all sorts of things.
So anyway, I mean, it is a potential issue, and we'll be keeping an eye on it, and I'm sure many other people will be as well, because, you know, it could really suck if developers don't deal with it, but I think they have ways of doing it. I mean, I don't think, if it was a major problem, I don't think Nintendo would put it out there so prominently. I mean, like, something like Wii Speak is clearly kind of a shitty idea.
It's genius.
For doing voice chat.
We should have talked about that during New Business.
Yeah.
Another time, but I mean, that technology is not something that Nintendo really threw their weight behind. But Wii Motion Plus, they're doing Wii Sports. I mean, that is their biggest franchise
right
now.
And I mean, the marketing push is already evidently massive.
Yeah, and if this thing was really broken technology, they wouldn't be throwing a game like that behind it. So I have good confidence that they're going to handle
it. It would be Animal Crossing. Motion Plus.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the show now. Thanks to everybody who sent their emails. You can get your letter read on the air. Questions, comments, ideas, whatever, send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. In terms of retroactive, don't forget, if you have been playing or want to play Ninja Spirit, to leave your comments in the forum thread soon. So we'll get those in time for next week. And, there's another thread there about retroactive nominations. I'm currently seeking ideas for Super Nintendo games, which will be the next poll that we do in a couple of weeks. So if you have an idea for a Super Nintendo game that is either on Virtual Console or easy to obtain, say cheap, as in not Earthbound, then post about it in there. Tell me why you're interested, and I'll definitely consider that. So, looking forward to that coming up in a few weeks. And before we go, I just want to say real quick, I'm going to be gone traveling next week. So the current plan is to have a new staff member be on the show. Hopefully that'll work out well. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah, it will.
And I did pick up Bangayo Spirits for $15. I haven't even opened it yet, but that's what I'm planning on my trip, so you can look forward to that in a couple of weeks, hearing about that. I'm excited to play it because I know these guys love it. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, very good.
That's going to be the end of the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Most of us.
See you.
Bye.
Later.
So long.
John, I need you to make me a promise right now.
Shoot.
When you finish this game, mm-hmm. I want you to stand up and say out loud, preferably with someone present as a witness, I tap that ass.
I've already said it. That's the first thing I said before I put the game in the Wii. I was like, it's time to tap that ass.
All right, guys. Start your recording, please. Put on your ninja brain. Get into the ninja frame of reference.
I'm always in that frame of reference, Johnny. At any time, I could strike silently but deadly.
I always knew this is how my life would end. In a cold room at 2:45 in the morning, listening to John doing fart.
No, I have to imagine if you can't chat and all you hear are us going at it, though.
Yeah, I know.
That would be really fucking annoying.
Now you know how John feels during the show.